Well, it never hurts to ask. Easy now, easy. I don't want to hurt you. I'd like to think the feeling's mutual. Okay, have it your way.
Oh, very nice.
Oh, I'd say they were very evenly matched.
I don't know.
No, I'll still bet on the Sasquatch.
This is Infants on Thrones. The philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the core.
I would be remiss if I was on the line with you here and I didn't talk to you about the Sasquatch
yeah.
aspect. So is it okay if we change gears to that?
As long as you don't ask me if it was Kane.
That was the first thing I was going to ask you.
Well, we can touch on that because I get asked that over and over and over again.
I'm sure. Yeah. Okay, we're on it already.
Yeah.
So what's your thought on that? I mean,
well,
this is the I'll give a little background for the yes. listeners. So there's a story. I think it was originally related by David Patton, okay. and it was later written about by Abraham Smoot. If I'm getting that right, and it was actually quoted in Miracle of Forgiveness in the section on murderers, where President Kimball referenced Kane as being a murderer, and then included this rather yeah. bizarre story about David Patton riding his mule.
Allow me to read for you this portion from Spencer W. Kimball's book, The Miracle of Forgiveness. The Murderer. John wrote that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. The murderer denies himself salvation in the celestial kingdom, and in this sense he cannot be forgiven for his crime. The instance of the first murder is instructive. Though thoroughly taught the gospel by his parents, Cain loved Satan more than God. He became rebellious, carnal, sensual, and devilish. Cain was to become the father of Satan's lies and to be called perdition. His culminating sin was the murder of his brother Abel, which he did by secret covenant with Satan, and to gain Abel's possessions. As a punishment, the Lord consigned the wicked Cain to be a fugitive and a vagabond, and placed a mark upon him which would reveal his identity. On the sad character of Cain, an interesting story comes to us from Lycurgus A. Wilson's book on the life of David W. Patton. From the book, I quote an extract from a letter by Abraham O. Smoot, giving his recollection of David Patton's account of meeting, quote, a very remarkable person who had represented himself as being Cain, unquote. As I was riding along the road on my mule, I suddenly noticed a very strange personage walking beside me. His head was about even with my shoulders as I sat in my saddle. He wore no clothing, but was covered with hair. His skin was very dark. I asked him where he dwelt, and he replied that he had no home, that he was a wanderer in the earth and traveled to and fro. He said that he was a very miserable creature, that he had earnestly sought death during his sojourn upon the earth, but he could not die, and his mission was to destroy the souls of men. About the time he expressed himself thus, I rebuked him in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, and by virtue of the holy priesthood, and commanded him to go hence, and he immediately departed out of my sight.
Kimball didn't actually say the word Bigfoot or Sasquatch in there, but a lot of people, I think it's fair to say, a lot of LDS people have taken that to be, that's the explanation
right.
for Bigfoot. Yeah. So you're the Sasquatch expert. what are your thoughts on that as a Mormon,
yeah.
as a professor, as a foremost scholar on this? You get asked this all the time. I've got to hear your answer.
Sure. Well, you know,
and then maybe people will stop asking you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, maybe. Well, you know, if Spencer W. Kimball hadn't cited that story and related it without commentary whatsoever, no one would be asking me this question. But because that Miracle of Forgiveness is such a widely read book, you know, it's one of those seminal works that just about everybody has read at some point. It's widely known. The story became widely known. But, you know, and it's open to interpretation. It's been a long time since I've read it, but my impression was he didn't describe this as a hair-covered giant, but as a tall, hairy man. So does that mean he had long head hair and long flowing beard or what, but he did very explicitly say that that this individual identified himself as Cain, and he was cursed to wander the face of the earth seeking the destruction of the souls of mankind. And he then raised his arm to the square and rebuked him and sent him on his way, and arrived home in a fairly shaken state, apparently, rather disturbed by his experience. But, you know, what that means, whether it was in vision, whether it was physical, whether it was a great hairy Hulk or a long-haired hillbilly appearing individual, I have no way to determine. But
so in your Sasquatch hunts, then there hasn't been any large hairy individuals who've walked alongside you?
No.
And told you that they're Cain yet?
Not yet.
Okay.
Now, someone did write a very fascinating novel, and I apologize. Yeah. His name escapes me, but playing on that story is the introduction to the novel, and then he goes into the hunt by this intrepid cryptozoologist. And of course, we all know there was a curse leveled on Cain's head, that anyone who killed him would reap the curse 7 times 70. And so in the final scene, this is a spoiler alert. In the final scene, you have the hunter chasing or pursuing the Bigfoot into the cave, and it disappears from sight. And then the report of a rifle is heard. And a few moments later, a different Bigfoot walks out of the cave. And so this is how the Bigfoot legend has been perpetuated, is each time the individual's been killed, the curse has fallen on the murderer, and that person perpetuates the legend.
So it's like a werewolf or a vampire.
That's
myth,
right.
Almost.
That's right.
Okay.
So very clever turn of a tale, I guess. But as a biologist, as an anthropologist, I see this question as merely the question of the existence of a biological species of primate. It may be a cousin of a great ape, like a gorilla or chimpanzee, that has simply, as we talked about earlier, converged on our mode of locomotion, and so it's adopted because of environmental constraints or selection pressures, a bipedal posture, which is not extraordinary given the constraints of the shoulder girdle and arrangement of the chest of great apes. Walking on your hands on all fours is not a straightforward process, because we've evolved in a different direction for arm hanging and swinging, suspending our weight beneath a tree on a very flexible wrist and a cranially directed shoulder.
I want to talk about a number of things, but for you, what's the interest in, obviously you're a biologist, you're interested in morphology and in primates specifically, but, is there, you know, growing up, did you have an interest in Bigfoot? Is there something, kind of early on that drove that for you? Or is it just, you're in Idaho and it's something that you kind of fell into, or how did that come about?
Well, kind of all of the above. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and so I was aware of some of the stories about Sasquatch from British Columbia and Bigfoot and so on. And I was living in Spokane, Washington as a youngster, about age 11, when in 1968, Roger Patterson, who captured about 60 seconds of this fleeting glimpse of a Sasquatch walking across the sandbar and disappearing into the forest. He had showcased that in a documentary that he was traveling around the United States exhibiting. And I saw that. And, you know, to a young mind who's already interested in all things prehistoric, the notion of dinosaurs and fossil men and so forth, the prospect of a, quote, missing link or an ape man was fascinating to me, to say the least, let alone the whole mystique and the mystery of an unknown in our own backyard here in the woods of the Western United States and Canada. It may have influenced my interests. I was always interested in anatomy, and both human and comparative anatomy. Even as a youngster, I was fascinated with zoology, and I pursued a career in anatomical sciences with an emphasis in physical anthropology. And I was particularly interested in how animals move. I mean, when you think about what shapes animals. There are basically three behaviors that have impact on their appearance. The way they eat, and so that largely is apparent in their jaws and masticatory apparatus, the dentition, and the skull, how the skull supports all that, or the way they move, either to catch food or to escape becoming food. And so the postcranial skeleton, the body, that really takes on the shape. You know, a cheetah looks the way a cheetah does because it's able to, and it relies on its tremendous speed to run down a gazelle. And a gazelle is fleet-footed in order to attempt to escape the cheetah. And so my focus was primarily on how animals move. And I was, of course, interested in human bipedalism. And so my academic career took me down a path that involved the study of both non-human primates and how they moved, the study of skeletal remains, fossil remains, and analogies between those fossils and living taxa in order to infer and reconstruct locomotor behaviors of the long extinct species. But and more particularly, the advent of human bipedalism and our evolutionary history, what has shaped our body and our ability to run. And, you know, humans are unique amongst the primates in that we can run marathons. We can train, and we have the physiology for endurance, distance, running and walking. And that's really set us apart. So the prospect of another biped that would serve as a natural experiment in comparison and contrast to our condition was one that was always rattling around in the back of my head as a very interesting possibility. And then the falling into it kind of occurred. You know, it was very dangerous, risky to profess an interest in something that had such a tabloid stigma as the existence of Bigfoot, by an academic. But eventually I was naive enough to launch into it when some circumstances literally dropped it in my lap. And in 1996, I came face to face with a long line of very fresh footprints in southeastern Washington. These were humanoid in shape, 15 inches long, very spontaneous, very animated. And the hair, you know, stood up on the back of my neck when that realization began to settle in that, my gosh, you know, a Sasquatch just walked by here a few hours. Or else someone who was a very sophisticated hoaxer is pulling the wool over my eyes. And it seemed that at that stage of my career, I should be able to evaluate the likelihood of one scenario versus the other. So we pulled some casts from that. I started collecting casts from other individuals and replicating them. I have over 200 footprint casts in my laboratory now. We've archived over 180 of those by way of three-dimensional scanning. Those will soon be available to the public and to other investigators once we get our web portal reconstructed. But and I've published extensively, I've presented extensively at professional meetings, and not only proposed a model to explain the distinctions of the Sasquatch foot, but I've even attached an ichnotaxonomic name to them. Ichnotaxonomy is a parallel system of taxonomy that is applied to tracks and traces, usually of unknown extinct species, for whom tracks have been found, or traces, burrows, so forth, footprints, trails, but for whom the body of the track maker or its remains have never been found. So you have a handle. And after floating the notion of attaching a gnomon to these Sasquatch tracks with several professional ichnotaxonomists and presenting such a proposal at a symposium on Cenozoic tracks and traces, I got sort of the implicit nod, overt in some instances, to go ahead and submit the abstracts or submit the manuscript. And so there is a name attached, Anthropoidopes ameriborealis, Meldrum 2007, which simply means North American 8-foot. And there's a distinctive diagnosis. This is a consistent suite of characteristics that seems to typify the credible footprint examples that we have accumulated. And, you know, as one of my colleagues, a very renowned naturalist, George Schaller, said when he shown some of this data, he said, well, obviously, there's something out there. Now, let's talk about how you're going to identify it. I mean, that's what struck me. I mean, I was really gratified to him, to another professional who's familiar with primate anatomy, who's done, spent his entire life in the study of natural history of species across the globe. It was obvious. It's obvious that you have something, or there is something out there based on this footprint evidence.
So for you, is that the strongest evidence then supporting that kind of primate? It's not the Gimlin film, or it's not, you know, these kind of blurry images that we've seen on the internet or that sort of thing. I mean, the footprints are what does it for you.
They do. Because from my position of expertise, they convey the most significance to me. And
so you see a footprint and you're not seeing a smear in the mud. You're right. Seeing a joint, and you're seeing a knee, and you're seeing how a hip would flex on it and that sort of thing. You're trained to be able to read those signs from a track and know what kind of an anatomy would produce those.
Exactly. Yes. To the extent that's possible. And it's never, you know, in every circumstance, the conditions are varying quality of substrate conditions and preservation, age of the track and so forth. So, you know, it's not black and white in every instance, but when you have a large sample like I have, the consistency quickly emerges and the underlying anatomy becomes very apparent as it relates to that consistency and to the distinctions that are seen between our footprint and their footprint and fossil hominid footprints, you know. So, you know, my orthodox studies have encompassed the analysis of hominid footprints around the world. We've got a review paper that will be coming out shortly that does review the entire hominid footprint record. And many of them have unfortunately not been given their due consideration. But it's remarkable what you can infer from this evidence. Yeah, absolutely.
So a couple of questions then. What likelihood do you put on the existence of this kind of this primate? If there's a number, a percentage that you could put on it, based on everything you've seen,
right?
How likely is it? Is there a chance that it doesn't exist and these are all hoaxes and it's just, hey, there happens to be a lot of similar footprints, or for some reason there's a biased sample of these footprints, you know, the better ones are making it up the chain to you, and the really bad ones, you know, never make it out of the garage sale. What are the odds there?
Yeah. And those exist. I mean, and I have examples in my collection that are obviously fake. There's no question in my mind that they're fake. But you know, to be honest, I have to qualify my own opinion, because we don't have that definitive type specimen, or even yet a definitive novel DNA sequence to mm-hmm. indicate. So short of that, you know, if you want to say 99% certain.
So personally, you're quite certain.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
That it exists.
Quite certain that it exists. Yeah. I mean, no. When you sit across the table or across the living room from an eyewitness who you have come to know well, or who you already have known really well, who has had a face-to-face daylight experience, sustained experience or encounter, you know, how do you say to that person, well, you were mistaken, you know? I mean, setting all the other evidence aside for just a moment and just considering the anecdotal eyewitness testimonies, I mean, yes, you're always at the mercy of their credibility. You're at the mercy of their powers of observation and ability to interpret what they're experiencing, and you know, their suggestibility. You know, people sometimes see what they want to see, and so a flash of bear fur might take on the aura of a Sasquatch lurking in the shadows, and that person may be absolutely convinced that they had a Sasquatch encounter. They can't rationalize it any other way. But there are also instances like, you know, a woman in Denver or in Colorado, south of Denver, who had one standing outside on the opposite side of her tent, 10 feet from her, at 3:30 in the afternoon, 8 feet tall, covered with hair. She sat and locked eyes with it. It was kind of investigating her camp. It was very curious about her pack goats. And then it turned and walked away, you know, but this person is reliable, sensible person, And she describes it in extreme detail, and it changed her life. I mean, her life was never the same after that remarkable experience. So, you know, those happen again and again and again and again. You know, not like I said, someone seeing a flash of her, hearing a bump in the night, or attributing, you know, every overturned rock or broken branch to a Sasquatch activity. But the case is growing, you know, and sometimes I'm sort of singled out as that lone voice in the wilderness, kind of crying after this theme or this hypothesis. I work with lots of people behind the scenes, and I've networked with lots of agency personnel who have had experiences themselves or who've been the recipient of reports of people in the national parks or national forests, you know, foresters and game wardens and wildlife biologists and those of my colleagues, trackers and anthropologists and state veterinarians, state archaeologists. I mean, there are lots of professional people who are very, very interested in this subject. You know,
why is it then that, I mean, something's got to be very different then from this species compared to any other large animal that we've seen on Earth? I mean, I would think so, because that you're saying there's no, we don't have any DNA evidence, so there hasn't been any fur.
Oh yes, there is, there has been hair, but this, you know, the skeptics will just kind of throw their hands up at this, but the qualities of that particular type of hair, which the most significant aspect is the acellular medulla, the central core, which in many species has stacked cells, is devoid of those stacked cells. It has an acellular or a cell-less medulla, and that's not unique to Sasquatch by any means, and even some humans exhibit that. Individuals with very pale hair, with very, you know, strawberry blonde or pale hair might exhibit that condition, as well as other animals. Polar bears have an acellular medulla. They have a very hollow hair shaft, and that's why they turn green sometimes. Algae actually get down in that central shaft and grow.
Okay, but be that as it may, I mean, there's been no, I mean, there's not, other than the Gimlin film or maybe like a handful of, you know, fairly there hasn't been any kind of HD footage of this yet. There's no, I mean, people put these cameras out in the forest all the time, hoping to, you know, it's pictures of every other animal that's out there. Just about, it seems like, you know, there's elk and deer and, you know, rabbits and bears that'll set these camera traps off. And I understand you have a blimp project, or there's some project with a blimp in the works. So maybe will help, but I'm just wondering what your working theory is as to why we haven't had better photographic documentation of the Sasquatch. Right.
Well, in some ways they are different than at least the common wildlife that are out there. And even, you know, there are, you know, I could point to a number of species who have never had their picture taken by a game cam until just a couple of weeks ago or a month ago. You know, there have been some startling discoveries, particularly down in Southeast Asia, for example, and some species that are very rare have turned up on game cameras. So there's always something to happen, something unexpected that could happen. But those singular kind of examples, those rather unique sort of examples, are involving animals that have some of the same characteristics that apparently are attributable to Sasquatch. They're extremely rare, I believe. I mean, given the number of footprints and the diversity of footprints in a given geographical area. I mean, we frequently have repeat appearances of recognizable individuals rather than many different individuals in a given geographical area when footprints are found. So they're very rare. They are solitary, it seems. Most sightings and most footprint finds are of single individuals or what we presume to be a female with offspring. They're very far ranging. Indirect and direct evidence in terms of the distribution of footprints and the pattern of distribution of sightings suggest a home range of on the order of maybe 1,000 square miles. So they move through the environment in order to forage for more widely dispersed food items than what you would find in a dense tropical forest. So when you have all, and they're often active at night. They're nocturnal largely, it seems. Not strictly, I wouldn't think, but largely nocturnal. So when you combine all those things, the rarity, the nocturnality, the solitarity, the wide-ranging behaviors and generality in their behavior and diet, it's, in my mind, it's not that surprising. It's frustrating, it's vexing, but it's not that surprising. There's a growing literature on the use of game cameras showing that top predators are frequently avoiding the game cameras. Now, and whether it's electronic emissions or light leakage or scent, or just simply, as has been suggested, the novelty of this item, even well camouflaged, on a well-used game trail. I mean, these animals, they know every square inch of these trails they traverse, and you stick something up there and you disturb it, and they're paranoid about it. And they've documented, for example, coyotes circumventing game cameras. And they're just not always reliable either. One of my friends who's active down in the Texas area, in Oklahoma area, you know, he said, we had a game camera, an expensive game camera, deployed. And he said, we happened to be watching at this particular instance, and a bear ambled up into the supposed area of sensitivity. That bear was there for 20 minutes before it left, and not a single picture registered on the camera. So, you know, I hate to give apologetic answers, but the skepticism has to be tempered by a realistic understanding of the variables at play. And when you consider the variables, I mean, they're exactly what you would expect for an animal to have remained as elusive as it has remained. I mean, that's...
Sure, if we haven't found it yet, there's a pretty good reason why, or there's a lot of good reasons probably why we wouldn't have found it.
Right.
So tell us about this airship,
right,
with the project with that. What's going on with that?
Well, it's entitled the Falcon Project, and it's the brainchild of a colleague that named William Barnes, who dreamed this up after he had an encounter in California. He was a gold dredger, and he had an individual right about dusk come down into his camp and sort of inspect things and walk right through camp. He was hidden away inside his tent, but could see out through an opening, and got a very clear view of this creature. From then on, he, you know, and again, as with so many people, it changed his life, the impact, and sometimes the drive to try to prove the existence in order to vindicate their experience, and to challenge the ridicule that sometimes is heaped on individuals who acknowledge such an experience. But the point is, He conferred and consulted with various engineers and photographers and so forth, and came up with this notion of using an aerial approach. Aerial wildlife surveys have been carried out repeatedly. It's common. You can Google aerial wildlife surveys and find companies that provide this service to agency personnel. But they're usually employing fixed-winged aircraft or helicopters. And there are disadvantages to that. The challenge that we have is trying to find an animal that occupies the dense forests of the Northwest. And so having an airship that can hover some 2,000 to 3,000 feet over the forest canopy and peer vertically right down through between the trees with high-end sophisticated thermal imaging equipment and high-definition videography equipment, we're hoping that we'll be able to pick up, well, we're confident we'll be able to pick up heat signatures on the forest floor. And then once we've done some experimentation and identified profiles of common wildlife, deer, elk, moose, bear, and even humans, maybe even humans in costumes, just to rule them out, then we'll be able to distinguish something that's anomalous, something that's different, something that may be standing upright. And we'll coordinate with ground insertion teams that will attempt to converge on any target and identify trace and physical evidence, maybe even have a visual encounter with it as well. But the idea is we want to first, identify and get those definitive pictures. But that's when the work really begins. That's sure. when we start tracking. We start gaining knowledge about their movement patterns, their activity patterns, whether they are nocturnal or diurnal in the majority of their behaviors. And maybe get to the point where we can locate consistently and maybe even get a tracking device attached or injected. We had one gentleman who called us up who specializes in these little dragonfly drones. Mm-hmm. And he said, you could put a platform on your airship that these can land and take off from. You can guide them visually because they can be loaded up with a small camera just for navigation. And then have a hypodermic syringe loaded on the front with a little injectable transmitter. And this thing zips down there like a mosquito and stings the Sasquatch in the derriere and implants this subdermal transmitter that'll last for a couple weeks maybe, you know, because you're not going to have the size to carry a big battery and all that.
Wow, that is incredible.
That'd be something.
I mean, yeah, it would be something. You had better prepare to do a lot more TV interviews if you're...
if we're successful.
If this Project Falcon is successful, I mean, that would just blow the doors off of, primate research. I mean,
coincidentally, no sooner had we made our announcement of this initiative, ambitious as it is, then I was notified by a colleague who had just attended a conference on great ape conservation, and there was an entire symposium devoted to the use of unmanned drones in aerial surveys of great ape populations. And the example that he shared with me was the individual who was using it to identify tree nests of orangutans in Borneo or Sumatra, and I can't remember which. This fellow is now serving on our scientific advisory board for the Falcon Project on the condition that once we find Sasquatch, he'll let us, or we'll let him use the equipment to go to Africa and do some surveys for African apes.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah. Well, so what's the time frame for this project, or is the funding in place?
No.
The prognosis?
Because the plan, and again, the William Barnes came to me with his plan and asked, it turns out that the FAA regulations for a research and education project sponsored through an institution of higher learning has much more lenient regulations than a commercial venture would. And plus having the advantage of the auspices of an institution like Idaho State University, he asked that I broach this with our Office of Scientific Research. And I did. It's a little unprecedented because they're used to handling proposals for a fixed amount of money that are going to a specific agency, whereas we're appealing to the public and to private donors and commercial donors, commercial sponsors for this. Because, you know, as legitimate and as scientifically sound as this approach is, the fact that we're looking for Sasquatch means we have a snowball's chance of any federal funding, especially under the conditions of sequestration now.
Sure.
So that was the intent. So we're doing fundraising. We're courting sponsors. We have a couple that are in the wings, and a couple that are about one that's ready to launch a very ambitious PR campaign to get the word out. And then we've set up an account through the ISU Foundation to receive tax deductible private donations. So
if any of our listeners are interested in this and they want to kick a few dollars your way, they can. They can go to that website. We'll put a link up with this post to it, and they can go there and hopefully contribute to your project. I could see it floating over the forests of Idaho.
Yeah.
You know, the Pepsi insertion team, Sasquatch Six.
We had some interest at least initially. We haven't followed up yet. We need to do this. But Red Bull, which sponsored that jump from outer space, they were intrigued by some of the analogy there, and so that's a possibility. Might see Red Bull or logo.
Sure.
Is there any?
Yeah, you know? They've got wings, right?
Yeah, yeah, and I would say too to your listeners as well. One of the things that we're very interested in doing is because I'm always very a real advocate of the citizen scientist, that because of the nature of this animal, and the difficulty of an academic just going out into the field and collecting data. And I've been, you know, I've spent months at a time doing that with variable success. But it really relies on the eyes and ears of all those other people who are out there, much like, you know, national bird counts. And so the more people understand about discriminating data and collecting evidence in the field so that it will be useful scientifically, the better off. But in regards to the Falcon project, you know, when and if this gets off the ground, we'll be collecting terabytes of data, video data. And so what we plan to do is to parse this into packets that can be downloaded by the citizen scientist who subscribes to a web page, and they can review that video imagery and thermal imagery, and, you know, with a time code and indicate those anomalous features that may be of interest. Post them on the web page, draw our attention to them, and to the attention of all the other people who are looking at their video files, and that can be discussed in a blog format and the possibilities evaluated.
Yeah, so you're looking to crowdsource the time-consuming part of it with right.
Well, and involve them. I mean, so that, you know, you can look for Sasquatch,
right?
As well.
Well, I don't know if you'll be able to find anybody interested in that on the internet.
You don't think so?
You'd know better than I would.
That was fine. That was fun. I enjoyed it.
Okay.
Yeah. I hope, like I said, I hope I don't get a call from my stake president, yeah. Bishop here.
No, you'll be you'll be fine.
Be kind with the editing. Yeah.
Yeah. We're obscure enough. He'll never see
okay.
it. So.
Well, you'd be surprised. We did a thing. One of the other controversial issues that I've gotten roped into was the DNA in the Book of Mormon.
Right.
And written in the book. And we got roped into a Sunstone Symposium and got kind of broadsided by the organizer. But I suddenly got both Trent Stevens and I got calls from our stake president, and he'd been instructed to have a personal priesthood interview with us regarding this. And they sent him a tape. And he said, well, I listened to the tape. I can tell their voices. They're defending the Book of Mormon. And he goes, well, we want you to interview them anyway. And so
this was someone higher up than the stake president.
Oh yes. Oh yes. He got his marching orders from the area president. So there was someone in attendance at that panel and took notes and passed it on to the respective ecclesiastical authorities, and it was on the radar. So you never know.
Okay.
You never
know. Well, for the person at the church office building who's monitoring this, then do us a favor and just go easy on it.
Sure, there you go.
Okay.
You better make this a short goodbye, George. You've got to go back where you belong now. Hurry, please. Please, there's no time.
Get out of here! Can't you see we don't want you anymore?
Take care of yourself now, okay?
Okay.
Anyone for the closing prayer?
Now, Jocko, what for you?
I don't know. There's always Loch Ness.
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.